6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Here in the U.S., the Wall Street Journal reporting that special counsel Robert Mueller has seated a grand jury, significantly stepping up his probe into Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. President Trump, in a defiant speech at a rally in the U.S. state of West Virginia, spoke to the crowds about the so-called Trump-Russia probe.
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is.
Mr. Trump said what the prosecutor should be looking at are Hillary Clinton's 33,000 deleted emails. Clinton, the Democratic nominee, won the popular vote in last year's election, but Republican Trump prevailed in the presidential election by capturing enough electoral votes. President Trump expected to increase pressure on China to change its trade practices and do more to stop North Korea's weapons program. Mr. Trump expected to sign an order in the coming days to open an investigation of Chinese demands that foreign companies share tech secrets in an exchange for access to the massive Chinese market. Trade experts warn such actions might violate commitments the United States has made to the World Trade Organization. Ceasefire in parts of Homs province in central Syria has allowed civilians a chance to start putting their lives back together. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported no violations, while reporters say that markets have reopened and the children are once again out on the streets playing. This is VOA News. Suicide bomb in Afghanistan has killed at least 4 people in an attack that happened on a convoy of foreign troops between Kabul and the largest American base in the country. Taliban told journalists the bomber was one of its men. Flames engulfed one of the tallest residential towers in Dubai earlier today. It was the second time in 2 years that residents of the building had to scramble for safety. Cause of the fire not immediately clear. No injuries so far have been reported. Venezuela's election chief refuting a report that voter turnout numbers were manipulated and inflated by at least 1 million.
Hasta ahora, hemos contado.
Until now, we have counted 181 burnt voting machines.
Nuestra institución sufrió.
Our institution suffered and continues to suffer cybernetic attacks to our official page. This illustrates the unprecedented siege embedded in a strategy to destroy the electoral institution and impede the election of the Constitutional National Assembly.
Opposition containing the vote was rigged to pack the assembly with supporters of President Nicolas Maduro. And the president of Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, stripping his vice president, we understand, of much of the authority over corruption allegations that surfaced amid a battle for power within the ruling leftist coalition. Moreno says in a decree that he signed that he's withdrawing all the tasks that have been assigned to Vice President Jorge Glass since he took office in May. Glass has denied any wrongdoing, citing a lack of evidence. The Mexican army says soldiers have seized 37 gallons or 140 liters of liquid morphine and 43 kilograms of opium paste in a rural area in the northern state of Sinaloa. Doug Bernard has more.
Opium paste is extracted from poppy bulbs and later processed into morphine and then heroin. Much of it is shipped to the United States by drug cartels. The Army said Wednesday the drugs were seized on July 31st after an Army patrol saw a group of men flee. The seizure occurred in the township of Bariraguato, the hometown of imprisoned Sinaloa cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The Army estimated the raw materials would have produced about 140 kilograms of heroin. Doug Bernard, VOA News.
And it seems that the world is facing a shortage of the popular Darjeeling tea because of deadly unrest in the Indian territory, where it's grown. In fact, it's down about 90% of production. It's a showdown there between the native Gorkhas, who provide the majority of plantation workers, and the local government.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwandans are voting today in presidential election where incumbent Paul Kagame is expected to win re-election.
The outcome of this election has been decided a long time ago. We already know the winner. It's a waste of money and time. This is the money that could be helping most Rwandan people who live in poverty.
Diane Shima Rigara was hoping to be Rwanda's first female president, but her candidacy was rejected by the Elections Commission. A Kenyan activist turned political candidate. Cameroonians donate blood to support the war against Boko Haram. And Swaziland's Trade Union Congress threatens protest if opposition groups are not allowed to participate in discussions on the state broadcaster.
It is our belief that those public media houses are run through our taxpayers' money. And we feel we do have got a right to utilize those public media houses to debate and discuss critical policy issues of the country.
Onduduzi Egina is acting Secretary General of the Trade Unions Congress of Swaziland, and a top UN official urges South Sudan's warring parties to end fighting and engage in meaningful dialogue. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwandans are voting today in presidential election where incumbent Paul Kagame, in power since 1994, is expected to win a third term. Mr. Kagame, who some say engineered a referendum to change presidential term limits, says he should be re-elected to continue Rwanda's economic growth, stability and development. All indications are that Kagame will win another seven-year term, but his critics say he has used the intimidation and repression of his critics. Diane Rigara is a human rights activist who was disqualified by the Elections Commission because she failed to garner the required 600 signatures to put her name on the ballot. But Rigara says she gave more than 1,000 signatures. She says the Elections Commission is controlled by President Paul Kagame.
My candidacy was rejected on baseless grounds, fabricated lies. I fulfilled all the requirements. Actually, I exceeded what was required of me. The required number of signatures was 600. I almost doubled that number. I submitted over 1,100 signatures. So the National Electoral Commission could not explain how I'm not on the final list of candidates. That is why they try to mislead people, making up lies, simply.
I spoke with the executive secretary of the National Elections Commission twice, and he indicated that you were rejected because you failed to generate the required number of signatures to put you on the ballot from your supporters.
I gave the most signatures out of all the candidates. The required number is 600. I gave over 1,100 signatures. So that is simply not true. But again, I cannot blame the National Electoral Commission. They are not an independent institution. Like any other institution in this country, they just do what they are told by the RPF, the party in power.
I read an article in the Washington Post that was based on an interview with you in which you said that you wanted to be Rwanda's first female president, but then you said fake nude photos appear online. Where did the nude photos come from?
The photoshopped nude pictures was one of many attempts to try to silence me. It was done by the regime. And it's not the only thing they did since then. My supporters have been jailed, harassed. Five of my young supporters have been taken into custody today by the police for just wearing T-shirts with my picture and the name of our movement.
As Rwandans vote today, Friday, what do you think about the vote itself? Do you think it's going to be free and fair?
No, it's not going to be free and fair. The outcome of this election has been decided a long time ago. We already know the winner. It's a waste of money and time. This is the money that could be helping most Rwandan people who live in poverty.
You're a very young person, male or female. Who do you consider as your idol?
I would say Fred Guigema is the founder, actually, of the RPF. He had a vision for this country. Unfortunately, he was killed back in 1990. The other person I would say is Thomas Sankara. These two people, I think, are my role models.
Rwanda, your country, has been upheld for having the highest percentage of women in government. Yet there are some people who say this is just a myth. Now, you are a woman who wanted to be president. What do you think? Has your country made headway in terms of promoting women in government?
No, Rwandan politicians who are women do not have any type of power, or they're not empowered. What we see, what we hear is not true power. It's fake power, because they have no real say in how our country is being run. The only people who decide what happens in this country and what doesn't happen is RPF, the ruling party. Just look at myself. What has been happening to me since I decided to question and challenge our government?
What are your plans? As I said, you are a young person. What are you going to be doing? Do you hope to seek an office, say, for parliament or what?
The day I was supposed to start campaigning, I started a movement called People's Salvation Movement, Itaba Azai in Kinyarwanda. And what we're doing with this movement is calling on to Rwandans to not fear, but speak up, stand up, and strive for our rights. So I'm campaigning with my movement, and we believe time has come for change in this country.
So nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa, and thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Diane Shima Rigara was hoping to be Rwanda's first female president, but her candidacy was rejected by the Elections Commission. She was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. You can expect some fresh faces on the ballot during Kenya's presidential election this month. The political newcomers include a rapper who is seeking a seat in parliament, a businessman running for president, and a prominent activist who was decided to try to improve the system from within. Lenny Ruvaga joined Boniface Mwangi on the campaign trail in Nairobi and has this report.
Impunity, yes, by the police. We are coming back.
From the protest march to
the
campaign trail, Kenyan anti-corruption crusader Boniface Mwangi is now looking to join the system he has spent a decade railing against. The 34-year-old hopes to bring greater accountability.
I'm tired with bad politics, I'm tired with bad leadership. I grew up in Sarare where I'm running, and there's a lot of bad leadership. School playgrounds are being grabbed, markets are being grabbed, our young people have no jobs. And I want to go to parliament and fight for those people.
Last year, Mwangi was leading anti-government protests. His gateway to activism was his work as a photojournalist covering the 2007-2008 post-election violence. Now Mwangi leads his four-month-old Ukweli party, which is Swahili for truth.
I don't think, as a young person who believes there's bad leadership, why don't let money, lack of money, or lack of a popular name or a big name or lack of a big political party stop you. Because complaining about bad leadership is not enough. You need to go beyond complaining, do something about it. That means that you run for public office. Please do that.
Mwangi has never held public office, but he is not without supporters.
He has a track record fighting for the rights of the common man. Before joining politics, he fought against legislators increasing their salaries and land grabbing. Basically, assessing him is easy, unlike other politicians.
Two main alliances dominate Kenya's political landscape, and it remains to be seen how newcomers like Mwangi will do. Kenya goes to the polls August 8th. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 4th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, Watukoskwa, has threatened to launch protests if opposition groups in the country are not allowed to participate in discussions on the state broadcaster. This after a report presented to Parliament revealed the government censorship at the Swazi television. Until recently, the state broadcaster even prevented parliamentarians from appearing on news programs. Swazi TV is one of only two television stations in Swaziland. The other station, Channel S, is privately owned, but its editorial policy always supports King Mswati III. Nduduzi Gina, acting Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, tells viewers Peter Clotty that his group will not be deterred in its demands for the state broadcaster to cover all citizens.
Following the Swaziland government's decision of banning even trade unions from being covered by the Swaziland television and broadcasting services, the public media houses, they don't cover activities of the trade union. Trade unions are not allowed even to make announcements. It is just closed. And it has been our call, because it is our understanding and it is our belief that those public media houses are run through our taxpayers' money. And we feel we do have got a right to utilize those public media houses to debate and discuss critical policy issues of the country. But that space is closed. Interestingly, even members of parliament were not allowed to make or being covered in this public, as long as they would be seen to be critical of issues.
If parliamentarians are being prevented from appearing on news shows on Swaziland radio and TV, what makes Tukoswa think that their call for critical voices to be allowed to participate in national discourse on TV or radio on the state broadcaster would be adhered to by the government?
Definitely, it will be adhered to. Failing that, we have set some motion for a countrywide protest, including that demand. And we have planned to protest if that space is not open. They have just opened for the parliamentarians, but it is still closed for the trade union and civil society.
But there are suggestions that civil society and trade union groups become political, they create tension, disaffection among Swazis, and undermine the territorial integrity of the government in Mbabani.
I mean, that is part of police. If you are governing, those that you are governing, they should have got that right to say you are governing correctly or you are not governing correctly. We are living in a democratic society. And if we claim, as it is so claimed, that we are living in a modern world, so we should be allowed to have a battle of ideas to see who is right and who is wrong. There is nothing wrong with those who are governing. Because if you are governing, you are having a social contract with those that you are governing. So you can't then censor them.
A lot of opposition groups have been pressuring the government for more democratic reforms. Supporters of the government are saying that allowing critical voices, such platforms, will not only create tension, but will create chaos, and terrorism will rise.
No. That would not be the case. Opening up the space for national development issues. Because maybe the issue that you are raising to say previously, or most often times it has been said that civil society and trade unions have been raising issues of not being comfortable with the system of governance. But clearly those are the very same issues that must be discussed in any democratic country.
Nduduzi Gina is the acting Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. A top United Nations official who was visiting South Sudan this week has called on the nation's warring parties to end the fighting and engage in a meaningful political process to resolve their differences. Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the new UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, says the endless cycle of violence is causing the people of South Sudan to suffer needlessly. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Jean-Pierre Lacroix arrived in Juba on Tuesday to assess security and meet with the South Sudan's leaders, including President Salva Kiir. At today's news conference in Juba, Lacroix said both parties to the conflict seem to be reluctant to ending the ongoing fighting.
In spite of the unilateral ceasefire that was decided by the authorities, fightings are continuing in different areas of the country, and it's certainly a matter of concern. It's a matter of concern because the continuation of fighting is certainly an obstacle to further progress in the political track, and it's also a matter of concern because these fightings obviously have a very serious impact on the population.
Lacroix says the fighting has displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians from their homes, worsening the humanitarian situation in the country.
This is a situation that remains quite serious. The UN as a whole, UNMISS and the agencies and those who work with them are doing their best to help as many people as possible, and you know, doing it in very difficult situations, very, very difficult and sometimes dangerous conditions.
This is Lacroix's second visit to Juba. He says he met with President Kiir, First Vice President Taban Dengai, and other officials to press them to restore peace and stability in the country, revitalize the 2015 peace agreement, and to deploy the Regional Protection Force. Lacroix says 150 peacekeepers from Bangladesh have been deployed in recent months as part of the Regional Protection Force aimed at protecting major installations across the country, including Juba International Airport.
The deployment of RPF is, as you know, ongoing. It has been probably slower than all of us would have hoped for, but things are now accelerating, which is a good thing. A number of units have already been deployed in Juba. A number of other units will be deploying soon in the coming months.
Lacroix says the UN is making every possible effort to expedite the process. He says the UN plans to deploy 4 battalions in the coming months from Rwanda to boost security in the country. Lacroix also visited Malakal, capital of the former Upper Nile state, one of several areas that has seen stepped-up fighting over the past years. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Cameroonians have been supporting the war effort against Boko Haram by donating blood for the wounded, but officials say the country's blood banks continue to run short. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Hundreds of people have been gathering at the courtyard of the city council in Yaoundé to donate blood for Cameroonian soldiers fighting the Boko Haram insurgency. Among them is 50-year-old Anatol Bina, who is waiting to be tested to see if he can donate.
Nous le devons beaucoup de respect.
He says he owes the military respect and encourages them to go ahead defending Cameroon from acts of terror. He says if he is approved to donate blood, he will not hesitate to give every time he can. Cameroon has deployed more than 3,000 troops to its northern border with Nigeria as part of the multinational joint task force battling Boko Haram. Another 1,000 soldiers are on the country's eastern border with the troubled Central African Republic to keep rebels out of Cameroon's territory. Since it began its offensive 2 years ago, the regional force has chased Boko Haram out of much of the territory it once held, but raids and suicide bombings have continued. Officials say hundreds of people wounded in Boko Haram violence, including soldiers, have died partly due to blood shortages. According to the Ministry of Health, Cameroon runs short by at least 400,000 pints of blood every year. Dr. Biwole Sida of the General Hospital in Yaoundé says donations help, but still are not enough to meet the need. The doctor says 13% of donated blood is rejected due to the high prevalence rate of hepatitis B. Among those helping fill empty blood banks is the South African community. Zanele Makina, South Africa's High Commissioner to Cameroon, says it was able to collect blood from at least 200 people this week.
It's amazing. It's very good. We did not expect so much response from Cameroonians, but the moment they saw the set where we had set up our area of blood donation, even market kids were selling their wares. The moment they heard they saw musicians singing, they would come and say, "We also want to give blood."
In a statement, the military said it is heartened by the initiative. Cameroonian President Paul Biya has encouraged citizens to support the military. The government says it has received large food consignments and as much as $6 million in donations for the soldiers over the past 2 years. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the 16th edition of the IWAF World Championships, which begins in London today, with around 2,000 athletes from 200 nations expected to participate in the event in London. All eyes will be on Kenya, as the East African country is expected to have its first medals later tonight when World 10,000-meter silver medalist Geoffrey Kamawuru, Olympic 10,000-meter silver medalist Paul Tanui and World Half Marathon silver medalist Bendan Karoki battle in the men's 10,000 meters final on the opening day of the World Championship. 800 meters world champion David Rudisha pulled out after getting an injury just days before the championship, and he says he hopes to compete again very soon.
With good physiotherapy and good treatment for about 3 to 4 weeks, I think I should be fully back. And exactly that what happened in 2016, because it's the same problem, same muscle, same part.
And to some rugby news, the 2023 Rugby World Cup may likely be staged in South Africa. This was after the Sports and Recreation Minister, Tola Nkesi, said Cabinet and the South African government has provided the required 2.7 billion rand financial guarantee for the South African rugby to bid for the 2023 Rugby World Cup tournament.
We have learned from the 2010 World Cup various mistakes which were committed, where we ended up with a lot of money which had to be paid after the tournament. And we have put very stringent conditions, and all that must be followed in relation to this World Cup.
Now to basketball news. The Angolan national senior women's basketball team lost to Brazil by 57-63 in a friendly match which was played as part of their preparations ahead of their participation in the African Cup of Nations Afro Basket 2017 to take place in Bamako, Mali. Angola is in Group A alongside Cameroon, Cote d'Ivoire, Tunisia and Mali. Senegal are the defending champion. And now to football news. Serbian-born former Ugandan national coach Milutin Micho Sederovic will return to Orlando Pirates as head coach after a previous brief stint in charge of the Soweto Giants more than a decade ago. He was confirmed on a 3-year deal just a day after Kijil Javanaret tendered his resignation. Ivan Kosa, Orlando Pirates chairperson, says Micho is the right man for the job.
Good experience, having traversed the continent. He understands the game. He was in touch with our game. He knows all the players in South Africa. He watches all our games. So that in itself comes with the added value.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your reporting on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa news. Rwandans are voting today in presidential election, where incumbent Paul Kagame, in power since 1994, is expected to win a third term. And that is it for this Friday, August 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty saying have a lovely weekend.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Are you ready to get your 55-minute fix of Pan-African music and music news? Well, good. I've got a playlist of infectious current songs from Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Uganda, Mali, and Nigeria. Also, a few classics tossed in that promise to make you smile. And wait till you hear a sample of Boko Bakata. That album just dropped. And I've got an exclusive interview with the artist from London just for you. So tune in, peeps, and feast your ears Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC.